Welcome back, everyone, to Keeping Current, the podcast from ERS and HVM designed to plug you into the world of electrical power systems. I'm your host, Joe Dwyer, and in this episode, we're diving into a situation no facility ever wants to face: unexpected outages and near disaster events. Joining me today is my good friend Nick Palko, a business development manager and engineer who works hands-on with electrical systems, and Matt Saunders, a professional who's experienced firsthand how close calls and outages can test resilience. Together, they'll share their stories of recovery, the lessons learned, and what it really takes to prevent the next crisis. So get ready to unplug and connect, and welcome to Keeping Current, Nick and Matt.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure. Well, to start us off, tell us about your roles and how you first recognized that something was amiss that could lead to a bigger problem or even disaster-level situation.
So it was funny. I was working in a power plant in Elmwood Park, New Jersey. We had just started doing testing work at this one plant years ago. Lead had asked me, he's like, "Hey, Nick, every once in a while we get intermittent trips on our switchgear and whatnot." He goes, "Is there anything you guys can do to help us prevent things like that?" So I said, "Well, show me your battery room." The batteries look like basketballs. Now, typically, when you walk into a battery room, you see square jars and things of that nature. These were round. They were rounded over, which meant they were almost going into thermal runaway.
That's exactly right. Yeah, yeah.
And it was kind of wild because this plant had been mothballed. It was attached to another. It was attached to a paper mill, and they divorced it from the paper mill, and they used it as just a generator. And
I think it was a peaker plant. Like when the grid got unstable, they'd have to fire.
Yeah, correct. 100%. Yep. So it was kind of funny because they were putting a bunch of money. The private equity company that was owning it at the time kept putting money into it and whatnot. And essentially, we had to basically take the whole DC system down, put a temp in. The lead times were long, not as long as they are now, but they were pretty long. And we had to get two chargers.
Yeah, I think essentially you called me and it was like an emergency. We had to take it down. So oddly enough, it was around the corner from my Jersey warehouse. So we brought over chargers, temp batteries, and then we just hot swapped it and got everything tied in on a temporary source, because I think the flooded cells that we wound up having to replace, yeah, there was like a 12-week lead time or something, and they couldn't go down.
Well, that's awesome. That's a great way to set the stage. Nick, if you could, can you go a little deeper on the engineering side so we can understand what triggered the event from your perspective? Was it lack of maintenance? Was it subpar equipment? What do you think it was?
The system as a whole was old. Like, the plant was built in, like, back in the late 60s and 70s, so it was one of those things where, you know, the age of the plant didn't do it any favors either.
Yeah, I think a lot of it, too, is I think there was a changing of leadership. So, like, new people came in, maybe information wasn't transposed, like, for maintenance or, like, what kind of upkeep needs to be done to keep the operational integrity, like, as designed. You know, when that type of situation happens, you usually have the oh crap moment, and then people like Nick and I got to jump on it and come up with ways to make sure that they stay on.
Yeah, I totally agree. I come from a power plant background myself, and a lot of the issues that we're talking about and bringing up, I've had to address as well.
And I think there was something also kind of crazy with the way the peaker plant worked. If they had like an SLA with the utility, so if they were called on, if they didn't like energize and supply power to the grid within some sort of time frame, like an hour, there was like I feel like it was like $175,000 like a day in SLA, that like as a penalty if they couldn't go online, I think, because they were just on standby until they were called. Nick, I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, it was something like that. I don't remember the dollar figure exactly, but there was something. A lot of those plants always get paid to be readily available. So, and when they're not, a problem.
Yeah, I understand about that. Those nasty contracts get in the way. Well, one thing I wanted to ask is there's sort of an epiphany when you realized that something wasn't right, aside from the batteries looking like basketballs, when did you guys first realize, like, we had an uh-oh moment and, you know, we need to change course?
Well, I knew when Nick called me.
Yeah. The minute I called Matt, and I think I called him from the battery room. And if you've ever been in a, you have two types of battery rooms in power plants. You have the one that's completely organized, the one on the planet, or you have the one that's the broom closet and supplies. And this one was a broom closet at the time.
It sounded like things unfolded quickly there. It was like nobody realized what was going on, a lack of attention, and then all of a sudden the manure hit the fan. Once you guys realized that, how did the situation escalate, and how did you feel like what were going to be your first steps in managing the risk?
Well, I mean, I can speak from my end when if I get a phone call from Nick and it's like an emergency, more importantly than engineering and anything else is competitive urgency and wanting to just take care of the client. And Nick and I think we've always had that in the 18 years we've been working together. So when he calls me and says, I need temp systems, chargers, and batteries, you know, it's like an unwritten like bond that we have. We're not toying around with paperwork and purchase orders. We figure out the paperwork on the back end. It's just getting the sizes, the voltage, and the duration of runtime. So that engineering kind of kicks into motion, and how quickly can we deploy? And I think we were on site in a matter of an hour or two with gear to support. And, you know, working for your friends, you always want to make sure that you make them look good because they're going to continue to make you look good.
Believe it or not, Matt, I grew up right near Elmwood Park. So when Nick was telling me where it occurred and stuff, I was like, I remember that location. So yeah, grew up that near there. And in that moment that, you know, you're putting everything into place, what were the immediate concerns? Was it safety, operations, or the business impact? Because as professionals in the electrical world, like we are, you're balancing the client, you're balancing safety. You know, what was your first concern?
Yeah, absolutely. It was operation of the plant. They had two strings. One was a 24 volt system, and one was a 125. The 125 basically maintained all their switch gear. It was all control voltages. So without their DC, they basically couldn't operate anything. They could open it, but they couldn't close anything because of it. So.
And then I'm sure safety was also a significant concern because.
Oh yeah.
I noticed, you know, when I was running my power plant out west in Nevada, a lot of people they put on blinders and they only look at, okay, we got to get this thing up. They got to get this thing up, and they're not looking at the ramifications if we don't set up some safety guidelines. Make sure, you know, especially in battery rooms, you want proper ventilation. You want to make sure that you have ergonomic concerns addressed. You want to make sure that you have a place to place the old batteries safely, because those batteries, when they get in that condition, are very volatile. So there's a lot on your plate.
Yeah. I mean, we always look at, you know, safety is always obviously important, especially when you're dealing with DC, because it's pretty unforgiving. But I mean, the amount of training, and, you know, Nick can speak to it too at the different places. When you're dealing with high voltage, any voltage or DC, you know, you have trained professionals that know what they're doing. They understand the risk, and you have obviously your PPE, you know, that you would need to wear, and any site-specific instructions that a power plant or a data center or wherever. But this power plant, you know, we probably had, I don't even remember, but I guarantee there was an orientation. And, you know, from the safety standpoint too, all my guys are OSHA 30 construction, NFPA 70E, lockout, tagout certified. Some of them are first aid and CPR, because a lot of sites have requirements that at least one or a foreman has that in case you have to, you know, help someone who gets caught or whatever.
Sure.
So that's definitely a concern. And I mean, there's a rise in that too, in the industry just as a whole, because there's so much work going on and there's a lot of people with not a lot of experience. So safety is always at the forefront.
Yep. It has to be, you know, safety. And in my world, running my power plant and remote, when I was in the military, remote locations, you had to make sure that, you know, those safety guidelines like you just addressed are in place. So very cool. Excellent.
I was just going to say, too, I'm glad you brought up the military background. Thank you for your service. But the majority of my my field technicians and engineers are all former military, which is perfect for critical infrastructure because they understand MOPs, scopes of work, procedures, and doing that upfront work and having your plan, your PTPs, and your hazard awareness. That just makes sure everyone can go home, you know, at the end of the day. But military, that's the prime. That's the number one aspect I'm looking for when I'm trying to find someone that wants to do this type of work in a battery room or switchgear, because they, you know, they understand the risk and they've been trained. They're like perfect for it.
Yeah, I highly recommend Air Force technicians. All right, let's move on. I don't want to single out anybody, but well, that leads me into my next question. What was the biggest challenge in bringing the system back online? Because anytime we're getting to ready to press that button, we all have that rut-row Raleigh moment, hoping that, you know, we don't hear a big boom or something. So what was the biggest challenge bringing it back online?
I would say demolition of the old system. I think we had to build new custom racks because the batteries that we were replacing the permanent system. Because I think essentially we had two shutdowns. We had the shutdown for the temp system to go online and then the permanent solution like 12 weeks after that. So, yeah, I mean, there's always that anxiety. You want to make sure you double check and quality control and quality assurance, just making sure that everything is properly torqued, everything's been run right. The communication back and forth that the plant knows, like, all right, we're entering this stage of the MOP with a change of state, and all hands on deck, make sure comms are up and everyone can see what's going on. So yeah, just back to that communication. But yeah, there's always the anxiety of when you're about to change state and go live. You just want to make sure you have everything done right. You've executed the MOP and everyone signed off on everything. And you know, there's always risk, but you do everything you can to take all the steps to mitigate it so that everyone's safe and that there's no detrimental impact or something fails hard. No one wants to release the black smoke.
I would definitely agree on that. And in hindsight, was there ever a moment that you thought recovery might not be possible or that we could be looking at a much longer recovery time?
Not really, because me and Matt, you know, I know Matt was like, Nick, we'll get a temporary string, we'll get a temporary charger hooked up, and, you know, we'll go from there. But the biggest thing was assessing the old chargers, you know, and the batteries themselves. Like, that was only, like, we knew we had something bad going on, a matter of figuring out the path going forward.
Yeah.
I think trust comes into play when you work with teams of people over, you know, a decade or two. There's that level of trust that, you know, the people that are there are subject matter experts. Like, this is what we do. We're not necessarily like a jack of all trades, but we know 50% of it. Like, we're 100% confident in how we're going to deploy and what we're going to do. I mean, I know that when Nick and I have had a great relationship because he's been my customer, I've been his customer. It's just that trust, you know, someone's got your back, and then hopefully that transcends down to the customer, and then you've got a customer for life.
Yep. You must be busy because we can hear the background noise in there, and so we know you're doing good work, so keep it up.
Well, I apologize for that. I got three buildings going up, and I'm walking to between them trying to get to the quietest spots.
I believe it, and we appreciate you. You know, this is a little off the cuff right here, but one thing when you have situations like this is the cost of trying to get equipment, batteries, switchgear, and stuff like that quickly. So that's another issue that we would probably want to address. But let's take a step back and look at the lessons here. What safeguards could have reduced the risk on the client's ends, and what safeguards help keep this from turning into a disaster?
I think we caught it right before you know, two types of impacts, as Nick would say, like the plant going down hard, which we caught it just in the nick of time, and then just in the nick of time of, like Nick said, like mitigating a fire or an explosion, because flooded cells, they can explode like violently, and or catch on fire. So I think, you know, the timing right, like the client caught it at the right time, made the right phone calls, and I think a lot of it was luck too, just good timing.
Sometimes it's better to be lucky than good.
That's right.
You know, I always say, blind squirrel gets the nut every now and then. So, all right. Well, that's valuable insight, and I appreciate it. But with the new 70B standard, how has this experience changed the way you both think about preventive maintenance as well as system upgrades?
I think maintenance is key, but on top of the maintenance is sites that, when they get up there in years, is planned obsolescence and planned replacement, doing things in an organized fashion, if you can get ahead of it. But I think there's a, you know, they may focus on maintenance, but I think the neglect of doing planned upgrades, that probably needs a little bit more awareness for any facility, whether it be a power plant or a data center, because at some point systems hit end of life. If you can do it, if you can do your transitions in an orderly fashion, it makes everything easier.
And Matt, on your end, what changes did you and your team make in the facility strategy after the incident? Like, what did we change or implement to ensure that this wouldn't happen again?
I think we recommended quarterly inspections on the flooded cells versus like an annual, making sure the electrolyte levels were always taken care of. Nick, did we put a monitoring system on that so they could see everything in real time?
No, that was, we never put a monitor on that system. However, we did other systems where we put monitoring systems on it. But one of the things I will say is the power plant personnel were doing a lot of, they were trying to maintain their batteries, and they had this guy Nitin, who was their plant engineer, who was in charge of that. And after the fact, if you remember, Matt, I think we almost convinced them to, we had like a multi-year like service contract with them, where we were going in and doing, they were annual or biannual testing on the strings themselves.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I think we just brought some awareness and said this is like a best practice. This is what you guys should be doing. I mean, they were trying, but I think they needed to upgrade and enhance what they were trying to do from a maintenance standpoint.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you this. This is something that's unique for organizations that haven't faced a situation like this yet. What advice would you give them about being prepared for the unexpected?
I mean, we deal with it with that client, but all clients, like, doing the unexpected, sometimes you can't even plan for, but just from a risk mitigation and like having pre-done mops for certain types of things, like if an oh crap moment happens, what's your escalation plan, what's your response, so you can take action as quickly and safely as possible to mitigate injury and or outages.
That's good advice. Where should leaders start if they want to strengthen reliability before a disaster strikes? My first suggestion is open up your wallets and get the stuff that you need. That's my first suggestion. But also before that, you know, you need to listen to your people on what they need, not what they want, but what they need to ensure that they can react to this. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I one of the things I've seen over the years is when people usually try to go the cheap route on certain things, it usually bites them in the long run.
Yep.
Have it be, they try to cheap on communications or options or, safety stuff. Like, it's just even lead times now in this day and age. I mean, a lot of people are like, how fast can I get this? Like, you know what I mean? And even sometimes just paying extra money just to expedite things when you're having issues with things sometimes can be great.
Yeah, and a lot of times maintenance is like the first thing that gets cut when people are trying to justify cost savings, and that usually winds up not saving them any money in the long run. in the long run could be a short, it could be short. It could happen quick.
I've had incidents when I ran my power plant, and I would go to my boss. I'd say, hey, we need this. And it was specifically about batteries. I would go in there and say, our battery system is not good. I mean, we have boiling in there. We have burned plates. You know, you can see in there. I'm like, we need to do something. So what do you think we did? When the batteries failed and the plant went down, oh, miraculously, we have money to buy batteries. Okay. Well, we were down for 2 days not producing power, but we saved $1.89. Okay. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Right. So,
you know, and in that situation, you know, if you're not in the position to make decisions, well, then you're the recipient of the action of that. So, you know, it's just, you just got to learn from that. Well, let's go on to our next one is, what role does partnership between engineers and customers play in managing both risk management as well as recovery?
Matt, I'll take this one. I actually think when customers rely on certain vendors and engineers and things of that, usually anytime a disaster happens, the recovery is much more, it's a faster response and it's rapid, as opposed to you have an event, you know, you become responsive, not reactive. And, you know, yes, because you've already got you're prepared. And majority, you know, I know Matt's got customers that he's had for years that, you know, rely on him heavily during emergencies. Same with me. I mean, me and Matt have worked together on emergencies for years together. But my recommendation is rely on your vendors and trust your vendors, because they're going to save your behind in the long run. So
it's all about relationships, I noticed. Yep. And
yeah,
and how you treat your vendors, how you treat your clients, how you treat your engineers, how you treat your staff, all of that goes into the equation of what support will I receive when I really need it. And that's why in my world, you know, I might be biting my arm off in frustration, but I'll always be kind and eloquent when I'm speaking to the guy. So, you know, that's just experience and maturity. And, you know, a lot of times it just takes time. So
I think also just another thing too, is being able to, you know, do the engineering and coming up with the solution. As Nick said, you're solving the problem versus like just reacting to a problem.
Yes. Yes.
So
sir.
It improves speed. You get the system online, but also having the, you know, at certain times too, the financial people, having them involved, understanding that, you know, just too, like you want to make sure you pay your vendors timely. You know, you don't want them waiting 150 days for something when they got you out of your, you know, your butt out of a sling, and they helped you out. You want to make sure that, you know, you pay people right, and on a time manner, because that's always important. The job's not done till the checks are cashed. So you just want to make sure that
makes me laugh, because I had my own business for about 10 years and I had some very, very, very well-known clients, and you know, their terms were 120 days, and I'm like, I went to the person on accounts receivable, I said, well, what happens if I die in those 120 days? You know, and it's just, again, understanding your client, understanding the way they work and things like that. But
right,
well, before we wrap up, are there any final takeaways you'd like listeners to remember about resiliency and recovery?
Well, you're only as good as your partners. So if you've got good partners and you've got strong relationships with your vendors, subcontractors, that's going to be the best thing. You know, as we know, there's only two types of equipment on the planet: equipment that's failed and equipment that hasn't failed yet.
Yeah.
So just having the right teams to be able to deploy and knock work out, I think, is the most key thing that any facility that can't go down needs.
Nick?
No, that's I'll echo exactly what Matt said. You know, over the years, you know, some of the relationships that I've developed with vendors and, you know, even distributors and things of that nature, like, when you need them the most, I've always said it, emergencies never happen at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday. They happen, you know, on a Saturday at 2 a.m. or Sunday at 4 a.m. And getting called out of bed is just part of life. But I mean, having relationships will carry you through everything. So, you know, relationships are everything.
Yeah. If I could add to that, one thing I'd want to add is you got to make the in-house people of the facility that you guys are supporting. They need to conduct and implement and conduct proper maintenance, and not just, oh yeah, we did a wipe down or whatever, but no, good maintenance, you know, that is documented and maintaining their equipment. That I feel will limit and reduce greatly the issues that we're discussing now. You know, we're always going to have issues and anomalies, but I think the support, having relations like you guys discussed, as well as you guys passing that information regarding proper maintenance, I think those two factors will greatly help all of our clients moving forward. Well, hey guys, I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences and lessons learned regarding an outage. And you know, we've all been there, so I cannot thank you enough, and I look forward to working again and seeing you again, Nick. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for the episode of Keeping Current. If you found today's conversation valuable, please make sure to subscribe, leave us a review, and tune in every other Thursday for more expert insights. You can connect with us on LinkedIn to stay in the loop. And as always, thanks for listening. Until next time, keep current.